Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. In this episode, we discuss long-term outcomes after chest wall irradiation for breast cancer, new treatments for psoriasis and obesity, and early results on a vaccine for Lassa fever. We review opioid deprescribing, and a clinical case describes spiraling into a distant past. Perspectives examine the corporatization of healthcare, the health effects of new energy legislation, and Medicaid cuts affecting U.S. children. A new clinical decisions asks, carotid artery stenting or carotid endarterectomy for symptomatic carotid artery stenosis? This feature about a woman with symptomatic carotid artery stenosis offers a case vignette accompanied by two essays, one supporting treatment with surgical carotid endarterectomy, and the other supporting percutaneous carotid artery stenting. We want to know what you would choose. Visit NEJM.org to vote. 10-year survival after post-mastectomy chest wall irradiation in breast cancer by Ian Kunkler from the University of Edinburgh and co-authors. This Phase 3 trial evaluated the omission of chest wall irradiation in women with intermediate-risk breast cancer, defined as cancer that was stage T1N1, T2N1, or T3N0, or stage T2N0 with a histologic grade of 3, lymphovascular invasion, or both, that was treated with mastectomy, an axillary procedure, and systemic therapy. 1,607 patients were randomly assigned to undergo or not undergo chest wall irradiation. The median follow-up was 9.6 years. Overall survival was 81.4% with chest wall irradiation and 81.9% with no chest wall irradiation, according to 10-year Kaplan-Meier estimates. Chest wall irradiation did not result in higher overall survival than no chest wall irradiation among these patients. Janne de Boniface from Kapo St. Göran's Hospital, Stockholm, Sweden, writes in an editorial that because oncologic outcomes for patients with breast cancer have improved notably over time, researchers have embarked on the risk-gauging road of de-escalation of loco-regional treatment. The trial by Kunkler and co-authors showed no significant difference in 10-year survival between those who received post-mastectomy radiotherapy to the chest wall and those who did not. The absolute number of chest wall recurrences was unexpectedly low. Given the absence of a survival benefit from radiotherapy and the risk of treatment-associated toxic effects, this finding leaves room for thought. Furthermore, radiation-induced adverse effects cannot be neglected. For example, the detrimental effects on post-mastectomy breast reconstruction. The question of whether it is safe to refrain from radiotherapy after mastectomy in patients with positive lymph nodes who do not undergo axillary node clearance remains challenging. Individual treatment options will need to be discussed with patients and within the multidisciplinary team treating patients. Oral icotrokinra for plaque psoriasis in adults and adolescents by Robert Bissonnette from Innovaderm Research, Montreal, and co-authors. Icotrokinra, a targeted oral peptide that selectively binds the interleukin-23 receptor, is under investigation for the treatment of plaque psoriasis. In this Phase 3 trial, 684 adults and adolescents 12 years of age or older with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis were randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive icotrokinra once daily for 24 weeks or placebo for 16 weeks followed by transition to icotrokinra. Selective blockade of the interleukin-23 receptor with this targeted oral peptide resulted in a significantly higher incidence of skin clearance at week 16 than placebo among these participants. The percentage of participants with at least one adverse event through week 16 was 49% in each group, The most common adverse events in each group were nasopharyngitis and upper respiratory tract infection. Longer-term data will be needed to provide a more complete understanding of the benefit-risk profile of icotrokinra. Robert Stern from Harvard Medical School, Boston, writes in an editorial that the results of the trial reported by Bissonnette and co-authors, and in a companion article by Gooderham and co-authors in NEJM Evidence, show that icotrokinra was frequently effective and had an acceptable side effect profile during short-term use for moderate psoriasis. Accompanying the scientific and therapeutic gains in psoriasis has been a dramatic increase in the cost of its care. If the cost of icotrokinra and other new oral agents follows that of recently licensed oral treatments, $70,000 to $100,000 for a year of treatment, expenditures for medications for psoriasis may increase even more rapidly than the dramatic increase seen in the last 25 years, adding billions of dollars to healthcare costs. The unknown risks of long-term systemic therapy and its potential costs remain barriers to providing high-quality care to patients with psoriasis. Orforglipron, an oral small molecule GLP-1 receptor agonist for obesity treatment, by Sean Wharton from McMaster University, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, and co-authors. Orforglipron, a small molecule, non-peptide oral glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1 receptor agonist, is being investigated as a treatment for obesity. In this Phase 3 trial, the investigators examined the safety and efficacy of once-daily orforglipron at doses of 6 mg, 12 mg, or 36 mg as compared with placebo as an adjunct to healthy diet and physical activity for 72 weeks. 3,127 participants underwent randomization. 72-week treatment with orforglipron led to significantly greater reductions in body weight than placebo. The adverse event profile was consistent with that of other GLP-1 receptor agonists. Safety and immunogenicity of an RVSV Lassa fever vaccine candidate by Alyssa Malkin from George Washington University, Washington, D.C., and co-authors. Lassa fever is a viral hemorrhagic disease that is estimated to cause thousands of deaths each year in Western Africa and has pandemic potential. Recent outbreaks have occurred in Nigeria and cases have appeared in Europe and the United States. A candidate RVSV Lassa fever vaccine encoding a Lassa virus glycoprotein complex has been developed. In this Phase 1 trial conducted in the United States and Liberia, 114 healthy adults, 18 to 50 years of age, were randomly assigned to receive the candidate vaccine intramuscularly at various dose levels or placebo. The candidate vaccine resulted in transient local and systemic reactogenicity events, but no hearing loss or other serious adverse events. The vaccine had immunogenicity over a wide dose range in healthy adults in the United States and Liberia. Sevabertinib in advanced HER2 mutant non-small cell lung cancer by Xuning Li from the MD Anderson Cancer Center, Houston, and co-authors. HER2 gene mutations occur in 2 to 4% of patients with non-small cell lung cancer, NSCLC. Sevabertinib is an oral, reversible tyrosine kinase inhibitor that has shown anti-HER2 activity in preclinical models. This Phase 1-2 study evaluated sevabertinib in 209 patients with locally advanced or metastatic HER2 mutant NSCLC. Sevabertinib showed durable anti-tumor activity in these patients, including in those who had not received and those who had received previous treatment. Grade 3 or higher drug-related adverse events occurred in 31% of the patients. The most common adverse event was diarrhea. Opioid deprescribing in patients with non-cancer pain, a review article by Chung Wei Christine Lin from the Sydney Local Health District and Ailey Langford from the University of Sydney, Australia. Opioids are commonly used to treat non-cancer pain, but have limited effectiveness as compared with placebo or non-opioid analgesics, and are associated with an increased risk of harm. Deprescribing is recommended when the potential harms of opioid therapy outweigh the potential benefits and should ideally involve the patient in shared decision-making. Key strategies for opioid deprescribing include forming an agreed-on and individualized deprescribing plan with the patient that includes tailored and gradual dose reduction, with pauses if required, frequent monitoring to assess patient response and progress, and offering treatments to minimize withdrawal symptoms and other negative effects, such as the provision of naloxone to mitigate the risk of overdose. Maximizing the use of non-pharmacologic and non-interventional pain management strategies and providing psychosocial support and multidisciplinary care are also recommended. Opioid deprescribing should be a gradual, flexible, and patient-centered process to minimize withdrawal, maintain function, and reduce harm. Spiraling into a distant past. A clinical problem solving by Jef van den Einde from the University Hospitals Leuven, Belgium, and co-authors. An 83-year-old man came to the emergency department with new-onset generalized itching that had begun the night before. 1 month earlier, he had been evaluated for a unilateral facial nerve palsy and found to have elevated liver enzyme levels and splenomegaly. In the weeks that followed, he developed joint pain, swelling of the legs and face, malaise, and dark urine. On examination, there was pitting edema and a diffuse scaly erythematous rash. The patient reported that he had lived his entire life in Belgium and had been in a monogamous relationship with his wife of 50 years. Laboratory studies showed anemia, hypoalbuminemia, and nephrotic range proteinuria. Imaging revealed thickening of the gallbladder wall and bile duct with fat stranding, and a kidney biopsy showed membranous nephropathy. Further testing revealed type 2 cryoglobulinemia, lymphadenopathy, and pulmonary infiltrates. Positive treponemal and non-treponemal serologic tests confirmed secondary syphilis with early neurosyphilis. This case serves as a reminder of the way in which syphilis can masquerade as autoimmune, glomerular, hepatobiliary, and neurologic disease. The antitrust antidote to hospital and nursing home corporatization, promises and pitfalls, a perspective by Yasha Sweeney Singh from Brown University, Providence, Rhode Island. Investor-backed corporations, regional health systems, and private equity firms control a growing share of U.S. hospitals, nursing homes, and physician practices. This trend of corporatization is characterized by consolidation and the use of sophisticated financial strategies that prioritize the interests of shareholders over those of patients, healthcare workers, and local communities. Since 2008, nearly 1,000 hospital mergers have occurred, leading to a major consolidation of hospital ownership. Hospital consolidation has led to rising prices, mixed effects on care quality, and labor market concentration that can suppress healthcare workers' wages. The nursing home sector has also undergone a notable shift, with increased investments from private equity firms and real estate investment trusts. In nursing homes, real estate sale leaseback arrangements and substantial hidden profits have raised concerns about transparency and patient safety. Physician group mergers and corporate ownership have eroded professional autonomy and aligned clinical decisions with financial incentives. Although antitrust enforcement represents a critical tool for limiting the harms of corporatization, it cannot fully address the deeper problem. A healthcare system increasingly driven by financial returns rather than patient outcomes. Policymakers must pursue complementary strategies that center on health, not on shareholder value. Adverse health effects of energy-related provisions in the One Big Beautiful Bill, a perspective by Robert Glicksman from George Washington University Law School, Washington, D.C. On July 4, 2025, President Donald Trump signed into law the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, OBBBA, of 2025. The law will spur a massive expansion of domestic oil and gas production, but the public health consequences will be overwhelmingly negative. The OBBBA takes an axe to most of the Inflation Reduction Act's clean energy inducements, eliminating tax credits for the purchase of new or used electric vehicles and rescinding billions of dollars that the Act made available in loans or grants to finance climate-friendly projects. Analysts predict a sharp decline in clean energy investment, production, and use, and domestic greenhouse gas emissions will increase by roughly 190 million metric tons per year in 2030 and 470 million tons in 2035. The law doubles down on production of fossil fuel-based energy sources and reduces royalty payments while delaying charging oil and gas companies for emissions of methane. The many resulting health harms are likely to disproportionately affect already disadvantaged communities. As the consequences manifest, Americans are likely to regard the OBBA as sickening, not beautiful. Medicaid cuts and U.S. children's health, fixing a broken system. A perspective by Emma McGinty from Weill Cornell Medical College, New York, and co-authors. U.S. children are not all right, and neither is the healthcare system that serves them. Children face rising rates of chronic conditions, psychiatric illness, and fatal injuries. These trends have occurred alongside growing pediatric workforce shortages and reductions in preventive care. Medicaid cuts in the 2025 One Big Beautiful Bill Act will exacerbate these problems. Medicaid, which covers 4 in 10 U.S. children, shapes the pediatric landscape, and the OBBBA could harm children by jeopardizing their coverage and access to care, reducing provider payments, and curbing eligibility and benefits for children with disabilities. Reductions in retroactive Medicaid coverage may increase uncompensated care, while revoked eligibility for immigrant children could prevent families from seeking care. These authors call for budget-neutral or cost-saving strategies to sustain coverage, integration of behavioral health services, and stronger connections between the children's healthcare system and social services. Ultimately, universal childhood coverage, combined with sustainable pediatric healthcare payment and delivery models, could promote better health throughout the life course and help control spending growth. In our images in clinical medicine, a one-week-old full-term baby boy was brought to the hospital for evaluation of discharge from his navel. A growth of pink tissue at the umbilicus that seeped yellow liquid was noted. These findings were identified as a patent persistent omphalomesenteric duct. In another image, a 20-year-old man with Graves' disease presented to the emergency department with a 2-hour history of confusion. A goiter, bounding carotid pulses, and bruise over the thyroid were noted on physical examination, shown in videos at nejm.org. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.